We're taking you behind the scenes with entrepreneurs that run product-based businesses, people that were once in your shoes. Our TSBC alumni, speakers, and friends will shed light on growth strategies, resources, and inspiration to help you scale your creative business.
Hey friends, I'm Katie Hunt, the founder of Trade Show Bootcamp, and welcome to Proof to Product. Today, I had the pleasure of sitting down with Bryce McBeth. He's the founder of Reap Marketing, the only digital agency that hired itself to build an e-commerce business and optimize its own conversions by over 950%. He has gone on to create a multi-million dollar store that disrupted the salon industry. And Bryce also wrote a book about his journey called Salon Chairs Don't Sell Themselves, which I got to tell you guys is a fascinating read. He speaks and provides education on the topics of conversion rate optimization to help companies like us get better results from our current marketing efforts. His strategies and the implementation of the things he talks about will help you get more sales on your website. On today's episode, Bryce explains the difference between conversion rate optimization and search engine optimization and why you really need to be thinking about both as you're thinking about marketing for your website. He shares a shocking statistic that typically 99% of your online shoppers aren't buying from you. And he also tells us why slick and sexy websites don't always sell more of your products. But before we get started, I wanted to let you in on a little secret. We are going to be doing a free online masterclass with Bryce next month where we will talk about why SEO is a hoax. And he's going to teach us some unconventional ways that we can leverage our content to get more customers. If you want to be notified about the details of this class when we open registration, head to tradeshowcamp.com/join. Again, that's tradeshowcamp.com/join, and make sure you're on our mailing list. But I hope you enjoy today's show. It's a really informative, educational program, and you'll learn a lot too about Bryce and his agency and the brand that he built to test his theories. Hi, Bryce. Thanks so much for joining me today.
Thank you for having me, Katie.
It's a pleasure. I think what the topic you're about to bring to the table here is something that is super exciting, but it's also something our audience does not know a lot about. So I'm excited to kind of do a teaching lesson here, but also tell your story and all the cool things you're doing in your business. So thank you. Thank you again for coming.
Yeah, hopefully I can help you out.
You will. You'll help me and our audience. So thank you. Cool. Okay. So what is a common misconception people have around either digital marketing or marketing in general?
Yeah. So I think there's an obvious misconception that, you know, if you build a website, then people will show up. Right.
So, right.
And around that, there is all these perceptions that you can do things like SEO or social media posts and immediately start engaging with millions of people that are already out there without spending a dime. And the day you launch your website and put some effort into SEO, then the next day, everybody just shows up and money starts pouring into your bank account.
Right.
And the sad truth is it's really, really difficult. So for a product-based business or e-commerce site, you're competing with the likes a lot of times of like Amazon.com or Walmart or Jet.com, these humongous websites that are juggernauts that have sort of a stake in the ground with SEO and search engines and, you know, trying to earn that free organic traffic. So the effort that you have to put into getting the traffic, number one, is difficult in of itself. And then getting people to convert once they're on your website into a customer is a whole nother ballgame.
Yeah. It's interesting because you talk about, you know, they've got the positioning already because they've been doing it for so long, but they also have the infrastructure and the budgets too, the Amazons of the world and the Jets of the world to, you know, really overshadow what the smaller guys are doing. So you mentioned search engine optimization, and I know that you specialize in conversion rate optimization. Can you explain a little bit about what the difference is between those two?
Yeah. CRO and SEO, those are two different things and they shouldn't be confused with each other. SEO refers to the practice of, you know, writing content on your website for the purpose of getting indexed by search engines like Google in hopes of getting a number one or number two rank, and certainly a first page rank for a particular keyword that you want people to find you on when they search that phrase on Google, Yahoo, or Bing. Okay. So if you're successful, you might end up with a first page or even a number one link on Google. That might ensure that you have some traffic. It doesn't ensure that you get a lot of traffic. And it certainly doesn't ensure that you get sales. But it does mean that if you're successful with SEO, that you will, you know, be listed on search engines for relevant searches. CRO is different. CRO refers to the process of exploring ways to get more people or to convince more people who are already on your website to do business with you. So that can be done in a number of different ways. A conversion can be considered enrolling in your newsletter, you know, at the lowest end of the, you know, spectrum. Mm-hmm. Also could be pulling out their credit card and purchasing a product from you. Could be picking up the phone and calling if they have additional questions or, you know, want a demo or have particular questions about a product that you offer. So there's different ways a visitor can convert. So there's not really just one definition of what a conversion is, but certainly getting people to engage and become a customer is the end game. And that's what CRO is all about, is trying to convince more people who are already on your website to do business with you.
So SEO, if I'm understanding this right, is all about the traffic driving to your actual website. CRO, which you specialize in, is about getting them to do something on your site, and whether it's ultimately purchase, but if we can't get them to purchase, engaging with us in some other way, you know, email list or social media connections and things like that. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. And if you think about your site in terms of a traditional sales funnel, then SEO would be at the top of the funnel and getting, you know, more people to the website. CRO is more bottom of the funnel. Once people are on your website, convincing them to finish the process or whatnot. So I like to describe it in terms of an analogy. Like if you owned a Target, for instance, or if you owned a retail store and it was Black Friday and you were successful with your SEO and all your advertising, then ideally you'd have 1,000 people lined up outside the door at 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning, whatever time you decided to open your right. shop. Once you open your doors, then most of those 1,000 people are going to barn rush in and look for a particular product that they were hoping to buy, right?
Right.
So some of those 1,000 people who are lined up outside the door will find the product that they're looking for. Some of those people who find the product that they're looking for will actually pick the product up, you know, look at the label, check the price, maybe look at the ingredients, and decide whether or not they want to buy that product. Some of those people who actually picked that product up and looked at the details will actually put it in their shopping bag. Some of those people who put it in their shopping bag will actually make it to the checkout counter, pay for it, put it in the trunk of their car and take it home and not bring it back.
Right.
So if 10 people out of those original 1,000 actually completed the whole process at a Target on Black Friday, somebody would probably be fired, right?
Right.
So somebody was successful at the SEO portion or the advertising portion and getting people to the store, but somebody else was not very good at the merchandising and getting people through the store and actually paying for the product.
Yeah.
So CRO really refers to, you know, getting those shoppers and turning them into buyers. The sad truth is that, you know, 10 out of 1,000 represents a 1% conversion rate, but sadly, we allow that to become the standard or the normal for most e-commerce websites.
Wow. I was just going to ask, is there kind of an industry standard or a norm that people see with conversion, and it's 1%?
Yeah. 1-2% is typically what you find as sort of an industry standard. Now, everybody is kind of their own baseline. So,
of course,
comes in with their own sort of reference point or whatnot. Some sites actually perform much lower than that, just depending on a number of different things. And it does take a while for most brands to germinate. And even if you have a good idea, if you're starting fresh with an audience and paying for a lot of traffic or waiting for SEO to kick in, your conversion rates can be, you know, somewhat low.
Yeah.
As your brand tends to germinate, you do a good job, start getting referrals and repeat buyers, then certainly the conversion rates can naturally go up. But certainly there's, you know, 98 or 99 times the amount of opportunity already on the website ready to buy from you. A lot of times you can double your conversion rate and get twice as many sales without doing any more SEO or, you know, paid search activity. So
is it more than about customer experience on your site or the way you're positioning things on your website? Or I'm sure every company is different. Every e-commerce platform is different, but I guess that's why you founded Reap Marketing to begin with in 2009. So you could kind of deep dive with these individual businesses to find out how you could customize this for each of them.
Yeah. And it's so unlimited. That's probably is the most daunting part of the work of CRO is trying to figure out what it is that's going to make the needle move, right? So is it the photography? Is it the overall aesthetic? Is it the fonts? Is it where the button is placed? And, you know, typically we find if you have something unique that people want and they're willing to pay for it, and you're the only company that has it, the visitor will look for the button. You don't have to worry about as much about the user experience. Certainly you could make the user experience better and more likable. But if you have what people want and you're the only place to get it, or only way to get it you're the only place to get it in the way that you deliver it. You know, think about Amazon, for instance, and Prime, for instance. They don't have the best, you know, user design or user experience or website design. It's not the most aesthetically pleasing site on the planet.
Right.
But you know what you're going to get. You know when you're going to get it. And you know that the price is at least going to be competitive. These days, it's not even the cheapest a lot of times.
Right.
You notice this, but we've been conditioned to trust, you know, Amazon and when they're going to get us the product that we're willing to tolerate as users a less than perfect design.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, speaking to your question, you know, it can be the copywriting, it can be the design, it can be price, it can be your guarantees, it can be you communicating who you are and why you exist. There's really a daunting amount of things that can be, you know, tested and experimented with. We use a concept called the four pillars of optimization, which is a concept that we developed to help guide people through, you know, how to go about discovering, you know, what is going on with the website. So,
yeah.
You know, where most people are either very analytical or very creative, the four pillars helps offer sort of a blend in that approach. So the four pillars are, you know, looking at the data to figure out where people are falling off in the sales funnel.
Mm-hmm.
It also refers to just being creative and coming up with ideas that are, you know, come to mind or whatnot when we look at the website or, you know, go out, you know, through the rest of our day and some idea pops into our head. We also, one of the other pillars is, you know, relying on other client case studies. It can be interesting how we can derive the best ideas from seemingly the most dissimilar clients on the planet or other businesses. And even listen to your podcast, you probably get a lot of ideas from just listen to other businesses, right?
Yeah. In fact, I'm starting to bring on more a variety of different types of product designers and makers and business owners, because I do think there's so much value in looking outside of our own industries and our own niches to see how other people are doing things and how we can apply that. So I see wholeheartedly how looking at different case studies within your own client base could mm-hmm. lead to other ideas.
Yeah, absolutely. So the last pillar is best practices and just sort of, you know, keeping up with, you know, emerging trends and, you know, what things that you know are, you know, incorrect that can easily be corrected. So take, for instance, yeah. you know, page load speeds. We know statistically that the longer the, you know, page takes to load, the more people abandon the experience altogether. So you can have the best design in the world, but if it's taken 7 or 8 seconds for people to see it, they're not going to stick around to finish yeah. the sale. So that is an example of a best practice where it's easy to identify. And it's can be, you know, easy to fix. Sometimes it's not so easy, but you should just get that done. That's not something you have to really experiment with. That's just something you got to get fixed.
Right. It's just another check mark off to get done.
Right.
So you did something really fascinating, and I'd love for you to tell us the backstory of it. You started your own e-commerce platform to sell salon furniture mm-hmm. as a way to test your marketing methods for your marketing agency. What prompted you to do this live case study, and how did you land on salon furniture as your product of choice?
Well, it's sort of accidental, and it was sort of out of insanity. So I didn't really choose salon furniture. Salon furniture chose me.
Okay.
So as you mentioned, we have a marketing agency that specializes in conversion optimization. It's called REAP Marketing. I approached a friend of mine who owns the largest manufacturer of salon furniture in the United States, in North America.
Okay.
So I don't know if you knew this, Katie, but there's actually more salons in the United States than there are gas stations.
So, no.
Yes. Look it up.
Wow. I believe so, you, but I'm just shocked.
actually almost four times as many salons. And
wow.
when you factor in all the other beauty services related businesses,
uh-huh.
There's almost 10 times as many. So it's a pretty big industry. So I tried to talk him into hiring our agency to help him with, you know, lead generation and potentially taking his stuff online and building an e-commerce store out of it and optimizing those conversions. And the gist of it is he sells through traditional distribution. So mm-hmm. through other retailers and other, you know, field sales people or whatnot. So the answer was, you know, not just no, but hell no.
Right. And, well, the online world is a very foreign world to those only doing traditional marketing.
So. Yeah. And, you know, he has
sales channels.
Right. And he has relationships already in play. I mean, his largest clients were Sally Beauty and, you know, businesses like that that are multi-billion. If they found him selling direct, they wouldn't need him anymore. So I basically asked him, you know, well, if you're not going to do it, what's stopping me from becoming one of your distributors and doing it myself and keeping, you know, the profit margin And he said, you should do that. So after surveying the landscape, I felt like it was like shooting fish in a barrel. There were everybody else in that industry was sort of behind the times. And it seemed like an easy no brainer at the time, but then it sort of like became its own sort of entity and became a second business we had to manage. So anyway.
Which that in and of itself is difficult to have two businesses that are very different types of businesses
yes,
operating at the same time.
Yeah. It seems we sort of glorify, you know, this serial entrepreneur, but it can be really difficult and forget to glorify the people who can keep it real and have a good sort of work-life balance or work-life integration, depending on how you look at it.
Totally. No, I'm very much an advocate for work-life balance and integrating rest and relaxation into our days. But I also am truly an entrepreneur at heart who has a lot of ideas. So I can resonate with you and wanting to, you saw an opportunity and you wanted to play with it. Was it nerve-wracking or was it exciting to create a brand that was ultimately, I mean, it's now a legit business that has, that's profitable, but it was kind of started as a test center first, right?
I'd say it wasn't very nerve-wracking at first. It was actually really exciting. I mean, I really had nothing to lose. I could hire myself to build a website and then start promoting it. Once it actually just started generating some revenue and we, you know, went into it hoping to sort of shake up the industry a little bit. And once we were successful with that and started getting all the eyeballs, then it became a lot more nerve-wracking. And we had, we started hiring people and we started renting out more space so that we could attach a physical showroom to our business. Yeah. So once we had all that overhead and some momentum behind it and some people watching us in the industry, that's when it became a lot more nerve-wracking and a lot more of a serious commitment. At first, we had nothing to lose and it was really fun sort of, you know, breaking the glass.
Right. The beginning's always fun with adrenaline and the excitement of starting something new. I think it's once you get a little established and then you have to show the results of it, it starts to feel a little more nerve-wracking. Yeah. I guess too, again, this is a legitimate business that you run. It's a secondary business, but you do use your marketing agency to run all of the CRO work and all of that, correct?
Correct. Yes. So, you know, very much the motive of the goal of the business is to, you know, keep increasing sales and gain market share. So, you know, when you're a business like ours where, you know, resources are limited, you have to get really scrappy and start looking at every aspect of it. Right. So,
yeah,
you know, I think, you know, going into a business, it's really fun to think about, you know, branding and having a great website experience and kind of going through that process. But then when it doesn't meet your expectations from a sales perspective, you have to really start asking some hard questions and looking at every aspect of that and making some changes. And it can be sort of a love-hate relationship with your own website once you've developed the site of your dreams and then start being forced to make some changes and run some tests and experiments. And then you find yourself, like right now, I look at my website and I just cringe. I hate every aspect of it because nothing works. I can see all the, you know, dozens of changes and tests and stuff that we've run that make it look like it's sort of incongruent and inconsistent with what we originally launched. So we're about due for a whole new sort of makeover, you know, with all the tests and experiments that we've run and forming a brand new design. So
you bring up a really good point. So the industry I'm in, it's very visual, it's very creative, and it's very beautiful. Mm-hmm. And when I hear people in our world talking about they want a new website, I most often hear that they want something that is, I think their focus is more on the aesthetics of it and the style, the design. Whereas I think it needs to be more on the conversion, the user experience, you know, the flow that people go through. And I mean, that's what you guys do for people, right? So when you were starting Standish, like what were the first steps you did to ensure that the site was focused more on the conversion aspect than it was about the aesthetics?
Yeah, so I heard a couple of things there. You know, as far as to address the first one, I do hear and, you know, listen to your podcast and I'm a fan.
But
when I hear people talk about, you know, really trying to get the user experience to another level or whatnot and really focusing on the aesthetic, I have a saying that says, you know, nobody comes to a marketing agency and asks for an ugly website.
Has anybody said,
hey, I want my website to look just like Wikipedia's website. That would be amazing. But you're talking about one of the highest converting websites on the planet, right? Or same thing for Amazon. Or any of the other sites that we talked about. 1-800-PetMeds, not a very glamorous looking website, but one of the highest converting regarded as one of the highest converting websites on the planet.
Because it gets the job done.
It gets the job done. Yeah. So I tend to tell people design has nothing to do with it. But in reality, we have a system for forcing people to look at the deeper drivers and what convinces people to buy from you. Mm-hmm. But by doing that, it has everything to do with design, because a good designer will take that and actually reflect those, you know, values in the design. As long as, you know, beauty isn't the only sort of like purpose driving the design, you can usually get the job done. And what I'd say about some of the things I've observed about some of your other, you know, guests and some of the other businesses in your network is what I can say as far as like collection of data or having data-driven decisions, I will say that most of them really sound like they're very in tune with who their buyer is and why they buy from them, right? Somebody like that has collected a lot of consciously or unconsciously or subconsciously.
Yeah.
They have collected a lot of qualitative data. And because of that reason, they're very in tune with their customer and can do a very good job with the design and be very good with their judgment of the overall design. That doesn't mean it's perfect, but usually their first version is really good. Where I went wrong in our first version is I fell into the trap of wanting a beautiful website. With Standish, you asked about what we did to ensure a good converting site. And as I wrote about in my book, we discovered our first version was very beautiful and it disrupted the industry, achieved all of our goals, except for our sales were not where we expected them to be. So that was an example where we had to really kind of take a hard look at that and kind of change the aesthetic and forfeit some of the aesthetic for functionality and something that was a little bit more familiar for our audience.
Yeah. Okay. I want to talk about your book in a minute, but I also want to go back to something you just said, whether or not people are like intentionally collecting data or unintentionally collecting it. You live and breathe this. You live and breathe conversion optimization, but a lot of people, myself included, I think we find it intimidating because we don't know where to start. And I don't know if it's because we don't think we have the data to do it, or if we're just not sure where to start. So I guess I want to ask you, what are some common fears that you hear from clients as they come to you and your agency and they want to make changes to their site to increase conversions?
Yeah. So again, I hear or make up two questions there. But as far as the fears.
I'm selfishly asking some of these questions, but I'm also just bantering here because I find this fascinating. But go on. Yeah. Sorry, I'm interrupting.
No, they're certainly related. I definitely see how they're sort of lumped together. The analytical side to me that breaks those
separate them. Yeah.
So the fears have a lot to do, you know, they come to us because they want to make these data-driven decisions. They want to be smart about their design. They want to get their conversions up. The fears really have to do with, you know, sort of surface when we actually get into the testing and experimentation, because we start pushing them out of their comfort zone and they're scared to potentially do something wrong. They're also scared to be wrong. So if they have an idea that then we bring to light that it actually works worse than the original version and it was their idea, nobody likes to be wrong, right?
Right.
So you kind of have to embrace just getting it wrong and being okay with it. The fact is that industry-wide, this is just our number, but industry-wide, 60 to 65% of all A-B tests that are run or split tests that are run result in a failure, which means our new ideas that we thought were great actually are shooting ourselves in the foot. And at best case, we might be treading water. If we're spending a bunch of time and money making changes to our website, then at best we might be just sort of breaking even on those. So the only way to really identify which of these ideas are really working well and which ones aren't is to do some sort of measured experimentation. So for small websites, it's not really practical to do A/B split testing. But for some sites, for most sites it is, but there's other ways around it. So,
and when you talk about split testing, it's just testing different images and headlines and, you know, a different maybe format of the page. Am I understanding that correctly?
Yeah, it's most basic form. Yes, it's moving things around. It can be changing the layout. It can be all the things you just described, changing the copy, changing the tone of the copy. Mm-hmm. Sometimes changing from third person to first person voice can make a difference. Sometimes making it witty instead of, you know, super sciencey or whatever can make a big difference.
Yeah.
Changing the price, changing the font. We found in some cases that, you know, rounding the prices to the nearest dollar, you know, made a big difference instead of showing the cents. And that was sort of informed by a, you know, business case, a Harvard Business Review article that we read about how people perceive prices on menus. Another thing is, you know, when you're designing a new website, you know, where the when you put your social media icons and your Better Business Bureau and Norton security seals, where do those go? Those goes in the footer, right?
Yep.
Well, we found that people did that just because that's what everybody did. That was the accepted norm.
Yeah.
And we were able to substantiate that, number one, in fact, that did make a huge difference in people's perception of the security of the site and the trust in the company. So if that was so impactful to their experience, like, why would that not be one of the first things that you would see, especially if you have a new business that people are unfamiliar with? So yeah, we experimented with moving it. And we put it in the header of all places and locked it up with the logo. And our designers cringed, but we found that that change made a huge difference in conversions. People really trusted the company a lot more, apparently. So
fascinating. So you wrote a book about your experience. Salon Chairs Don't Sell Themselves is the name of the book, which is a fantastic title. And this is where you tell your story of starting Standish, correct? And all the things you tried and what succeeded and what failed. Is that correct?
Yeah. So it's definitely a story of the journey that we went through to optimize our own conversions and sort of the pitfalls we fell into along the ways and how we got ourselves out of those pitfalls. It goes into sort of detail on some of the highlight reel on some of the most sort of impactful tests that we ran. Mm-hmm. So it definitely sort of sheds light on the sort of spirit of testing and the process of a little bit of kind of, if you've read Hacking Growth, by Sean Ellis, it's got a little bit of that theme to it and how we found the data. You talked a little bit a while ago about people are intimidated or feel like they don't have access to it. You have a wealth of data, access to data, if you have a website, but just simply by having Google Analytics on it, you probably have more data than you could ever, you know.
I think people just don't, and myself included, I don't think I know what to do with it. I don't really know how to read the reports or how to interpret it to make change.
Right. Yeah, it can be hard, but there's some, you know, some of the, you know, I teach some of our mentorees, like some of the most basic reports in Google Analytics, as long as you're paying attention to them, can give you a wealth of information to, and so the key is exactly as you just described, is making it actionable. Instead of just knowing how many visitors on your website is, like, that doesn't really do much for you. You obviously want that number increasing month over month. Right.
Of course. Yeah.
But really what's actionable is knowing where people bail on the site, or if, you know, where in the checkout process they bail, or what products they look at but don't buy. Mm-hmm. So all that information is all in Google Analytics, and it's really easy to dig up. And I'd also tell you that, especially for a lot of businesses in your group, like, they have access to their clients and they can pick up the phone and call and ask a few simple questions.
Yeah.
And understand more about their user experience and make changes based on simply what people tell them.
Totally. What do you think of services like crazyegg.com and some of those others that heat map your site to kind of tell you where people are clicking and where they're most active? Do you guys find those things helpful, or are they more distracting?
Sure. Yeah, I think they can be helpful for sure. I mean, you can kind of like highlight how people, you know, either hover their mouse over different parts of the page or how far they scroll. You know, that's probably even more helpful than anything. Mm-hmm. The only sort of pitfall to that is it can be sort of self-fulfilling. Like, you can see what people are doing, but you don't really know how they are going to react until you run that experiment and then rerun that heat map, right?
Yeah.
And also, some of those tools report at an individual user level, and you can watch their, you know, records a video session of how they interacted with each page and where their mouse went and how they navigated through the site, which can be really insightful, but can also be a huge time waste because, you know, how many videos you have to watch before you sort of assemble a critical mass that you can actually trust. I mean, what change are you going to make on your website based on what one person did?
Right. That's a really great point. You know, one user experience doesn't always necessarily show the whole overarching experience. Was there anything that surprised you as you were building Standish and doing your testing? You know, is there anything that you thought was going to be a total conversion winner, but it wasn't, or it fell flat maybe?
I feel like we run against those all the time. I'm still running against those. In fact, we just ran a test. You know, Airbnb is well known for, you know, very good user experience, and their design is intentionally created for the purpose of building trust between the real estate owner and the, you know, vacationer, the person who's going to stay in that place. So we thought we were trying to do the same thing. So we sort of took a page out of their book and had a Airbnb inspired design to our product page. And it really just sort of flopped for for lack of better words. But in the book, we talk a lot about our first version of our website. And, you know, we sort of read the industry as, we think of, have a mental picture of a, hairstylist. Many of them are very creative and they view themselves as artists, right? So we wanted to respect that. We wanted a design that resonated with their values. So we came out with something that was really new and innovative and had an artistic flair to it. And, it was very elaborate, innovative, and sort of ahead of its time. But where we missed the mark was, as I mentioned to you a while ago, there's more salons in the United States than there are gas stations. So, many of these guys, with all due respect to the industry, many of them are what I described, but there are also another group of them that really just shorten hair for a living and, live paycheck to paycheck. So really the affordability of the product was, more critical than a lot of times the aesthetic, the communicating some familiarity and having an experience that was something that they didn't feel like I had to train up to learn how to use our website was really important to them. So something that looked like what they were used to on other websites. So we had to kind of dial it back a little bit and be less innovative and more familiar and more obtainable.
You bring up a good point of they need to feel comfortable as if it is for them, not as if it's too cool for them or it's a higher level than what they're doing.
Yeah.
That's a really interesting point of view.
Yeah. In fact, we did some phone surveys and called the people who had built the cart but not purchased. And those can be really painful phone calls. I think I remember the first guy asked, I asked him, I told him I understood that he probably had moved on by this point, but, was curious why he decided to buy from another website. And he said that our stuff was too expensive, which I knew that was wrong because I'd spent a ton of time and researched, all the pricing in the industry and priced the product correctly. So he was wrong. So I hung up with him and called the next guy. And he said that we're too expensive. So that now I talked to two idiots that didn't know what they're talking about. So then I called the next idiot and you know what he told me?
You're too expensive.
Yeah. So after you hear that about 12, 13, 18 times, you realize that maybe it's not the idiot.
Maybe I'm the idiot.
So I remember about the 15th or 16th guy telling me he pulls the website up on his computer. I can hear him typing in the background and he pauses and he says, well, I guess you are less expensive. I don't know. It just looked more expensive.
Yeah.
So that's kind of when the white light bulb went off in my head. I mean, I could have been testing based on the Google Analytics data. I could have been testing a million different things to try to get the conversions up.
Yeah.
But once I had that sort of awareness and I was really able to dial all my efforts.
You're able to hone in on what was the first thing you needed to tackle.
Yeah.
So as you're testing these things, how much time do you give yourself before you throw in the towel? I mean, what's a reasonable amount of time to test something and see if it takes flight or,
Yeah. So that's based on a couple of different variables. Definitely your time tolerance. And I'd say that was it's another fear that I'd say creeps up, with clients is, being able to tolerate the waiting period to figure out exactly what's going to, pan out in the study. But I'd say the main two factors are, number one, how much traffic you have on your website. Mm-hmm. And then the other factor is the polarity in results. So if it's kind of neck and neck and you're talking about a fraction of a percentage point difference between the two outcomes, then it can take, a long time. If you're talking about potentially double, tripling, or quadrupling your conversions, then it can take a much shorter time or a smaller population of people. As a general rule of thumb, most websites aren't ready for full-on A/B testing until they have about 50 to 100,000 unique visitors per month. So there are, like I said, there are some ways around that. There are some ways to experiment without doing A/B split testing. Yeah, you have to have enough traffic, and you have to have enough polar results. I think for a smaller websites, you really are testing for the purpose of trying to get these huge sort of breakthroughs. You're not looking for small, wins.
Yeah. Is there one piece of advice you could give our listeners that's something they may want to look at their website and check? Or I know there's endless opportunities to make changes to increase CRO, but knowing that who our audience is and product-based businesses, is there one tip that you can offer them to go look at right now on their website?
Well, I think it probably relates back to a lot of the things that you talk about in your podcast, which is sort of like being, you know, finding your authentic self and communicating that very, you know, effectively. And I'd say, especially for small businesses, not hiding who you are as a company. So I mentor a lot of startups here in Dallas. And I find that, you know, a lot of them are sort of ashamed of the fact that it's just a guy or two guys. So they put a bunch of fluff on their About Us page and avoid talking about who they are as individuals and avoid embracing the fact that it's just a guy. So they put all this stuff on there to make it sound like a big corporation that deals with a lot of companies. But I find that a lot of these smaller businesses, when you embrace that individuality and that authenticity, and you show who you are and you describe your motive and your the reason why you're in business, and you do it really well, and people feel like they can relate to you and they can, they know who you are as a person. A lot of people sort of root for smaller businesses, right? A lot of people like dealing with somebody who they feel like they'll get more personalized attention as opposed to just buying on Amazon and not really, you know, making a difference, you know, to a company. So I'd say probably for your audience, one of the things that you could do is really sort of embracing who you are and doing an even better job. Even if you think you're doing a great job now, experimenting around how you can communicate it differently, not just having an About Us page, but bringing some of those values into the product page or the category pages or even homepage in different ways. Video is ultra compelling. I think for small businesses, it can be really expensive, but people are, you know, 6 times more likely to watch a video than read the same exact content that's written on the page. And after having watched that video, they're 65% more likely to buy from you. So investing in video, you know, we spend a lot of money on assets like websites, but we don't tend to spend a lot of money on things like video because it's intimidating and sounds expensive, but it can be a huge conversion influencer.
That's awesome. Thank you for sharing that. So if somebody wants to work with you and dive deeper into their own personal site or just how they're running their e-commerce platform, how are different ways that people could learn from you, work with you?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we have a couple of different programs. Our agency can assess, you know, your website and kind of give you a roadmap for how to go about improving the conversions on your existing site and audit some of your media and help sort of identify where the big, you know, leakage points are on the website and where you're sort of losing business. Okay. Mm-hmm. So the agency is called Reap Marketing. You can find it at reapmarketing.com. You can even request a 15-minute quick assessment of the site. And our team will be happy to kind of take a glance, precursor glance at it and see if we can identify any of those sort of no-brainers that we were just talking about, and a handful of other things that we look for.
Awesome.
And then to reach with me, you know, reach out to me directly. You can go to my website, my personal website at brycemcbeth.com. That's where you can get a copy of my book. You can send me a direct message on the Contact Bryce page. And that's where you can also sign up for some one-on-one mentorship time for conversion optimization.
That's awesome. Do you mind sharing a little bit more about your mentorships and your coaching that you do? Are they single sessions or are they more like a longer term?
Yes, it's still something sort of new for us, but it's we find that we have a lot of passion for the, you know, startup community and small business community. There's a big business can be, you know, really tough to work with sometimes, but finding these individual like you know, business owners and working for a small business where you can make a big difference is something we're really passionate about. So we've tried to devise a program for that. We've come up with a conversion optimization mentorship called Idea Funnel. And basically what it entails is once a month you meet with one of our coaches and we have an agenda we'll go through unless you specifically have some questions or you want something, you want to review something or talk about something specific pain point that you're having at that time. So we'll push you to, you know, try to make some changes, productive changes on the website that'll, you know, put money in your pocket. Also with that, we do a sort of accountability check-in halfway through the month. There's a lot of sort of worksheets and videos and stuff that supplement that one-on-one time.
That's awesome.
And then we're looking at sort of getting some of the peer groups together to talk about, you know, talk together about different changes they might've made to their business that, you know, made a big difference.
That's awesome. So Reap Marketing is expanding. You're doing a lot of cool things, mentorships and other things. Is there anything else you want to share with us that's coming up for you throughout the rest of the year for Reap Marketing?
No, I think the mentorship really is kind of where it's at for us for the rest of the year. We really kind of want to focus on, you know, growing that piece of the business and, you know, trying to connect with, you know, individual business owners and try to be as impactful as we can to small businesses in a way that makes sense to them and, you know, isn't, you know, when you try to sell an agency to a, you know, a business that might be, you know, making less than $1 million a year, can be painful if it doesn't work immediately, right? So it's painful for the agency because, you know, they have, you know, employ a lot of people that, you know, putting their brains to work and trying to make a difference, but it also could be painful for the client when it doesn't work immediately. So
yeah,
we really do believe in this program, and that's kind of where we're putting a lot of our
I think it sounds really exciting, and I think it would be really helpful to our audience. So I know you shared your websites, and we'll be sure to include them in our show notes as well. But can you repeat, where can people find you online to connect with you about the mentorship and just all the other services and your book as well?
Yeah. So BriceMcBeth.com. That's BriceMcBeth.com. And that's where you can find my book, Mentorship, or reach out to me directly. All the emails from that website do come to me directly. And then reapmarketing.com is where you can contact the bigger agency for deeper services to assess your particular situation, request a conversion audit of the website, and for us to go through a more comprehensive approach to, you know, finding where your next big conversion breakthrough might be.
Awesome. Well, Bryce, thank you so much for joining me today. This was really enlightening. And I know there's a whole lot more that we could talk about. So I'm excited to share some news with our audience very soon about how they can learn more from you in just a couple of weeks. So, but I'll share that in the next coming episodes as well. So Bryce, thank you again for joining me today. It was a pleasure. And
thanks. Thanks again for having me.
Hey friends, are you preparing for trade show season and having a tough time dealing with all the details? Well, I have a new free on-demand workshop that will help you maximize your trade show investment and keep wholesale orders coming in long after your trade show ends. If you're interested in joining me for this free masterclass, head on over to theboothblueprint.com to sign up. Again, that's theboothblueprint.com. I look forward to having you. Proof to Product is brought to you by Trade Show Bootcamp and hosted by me, Katie Hunt. Since 2011, TSBC has worked with hundreds of product-based businesses to help them uplevel, scale, and build profitable, sustainable companies. You can find our show notes and additional resources at prooftoproduct.com. And if you like what you heard today, please head over to Apple Podcasts to leave a 5-star review and subscribe. Thanks so much for listening. We'll be back next week with a new episode.